At least today, eh? Let's try and talk some Dhamma. I come prepared for that, but then you lot, you get me started off on a track somewhere. And I say Theruvan Sarnai or something, and then one thing leads to another, and then we just get lost. Alright, so before I get sidetracked then, let's get to the meat and bones of all of this. Right, so let us all then take a moment first to pay homage to the glorious one, the magnificent one, the undefeated and infinitely compassionate one. Let us remind ourselves how grateful we are to be his disciples, his students, and to have this opportunity today that we only get once in a long time in samsara, and that is because of a Supreme Buddha who has made the effort, gone every length to discover the teaching and share it with us. So to his name we make this veneration. But let us also remind ourselves that as we do so, we are also renewing our oath, a pledge that we take upon ourselves to achieve the ultimate bliss of Nibbana and to remind ourselves of our purpose here. So let us now take a moment to do that. Seek refuge in the Noble Triple Gem and observe the precepts before we begin today's proceedings.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
And then you ask questions. What can I do? Someone's asking, is it right to believe that ignorance is bliss? It's a good question. During my campus days, I used to have a friend, well, more of an acquaintance than a friend. I didn't really keep friends with people like that. But he was in a relationship. He was in a relationship and then he had another one on the side. So then I used to ask him, like, you know, why do you do this? Like, it's not nice. You know, you shouldn't be doing that. You should be faithful. And then he used to say, "What you don't know, don't hurt her, does it, mate?" Ignorance is bliss. What she doesn't know, doesn't hurt her, does it? So as long as we keep it hush hush, no one needs to know, no one gets hurt. So that's why I say, you know, not really my friend, but an acquaintance. So is ignorance bliss then? Is it true? Is it right when we say ignorance is bliss? Ask the Buddha. What did he spend his entire life as a bodhisattva? Is it to remain in bliss or to come out of it? This also reminds me of a scene from The Matrix. I can't remember their names. I remember Neo and Trinity, and Morpheus, but besides the three of them, I can't remember any of them. Are you all familiar with The Matrix? Yeah? Okay. So there's this guy. He's the Judas, if you remember the story. And so he's in the Matrix, and he doesn't want to be unplugged from the Matrix. So he goes into a restaurant, with the bad guys. And he's having a meal and he's enjoying that experience. Right? He's having a nice, delicious meal. I think he digs himself into a piece of beef or something, and then someone asks the question, "Don't you want to be unplugged?" And he says, "Why? Why do I want to be unplugged? When I can experience the delight of this meat. As I savor every mouthful of it, and I can enjoy its bliss, why do I want to be unplugged?" See, people ask the same question. You know, sometimes people are so scared to listen to the Dhamma. I've come across people like that. Maybe that is why some people don't come here. Perhaps you invite some, but they don't come because they're really scared. They don't want to listen to the Dhamma, lest they lose the pleasure that they've always known. Because what they see is people come and they listen to the Dhamma, they begin to let go of things, the things that have been bringing them worldly pleasures, they begin to let go, and eventually you become a monk who has nothing. So when people think that this is the end of this journey, where I have to let go of everything, I've got to let go of my house, I've got to let go of my money, I've got to let go of all my wealth and my property and my children and my wife and my friends and my toys and my games and all my, you know, all the things I do, all the things I've been enjoying, traveling the world. Oh, that seems like a pretty bad deal. If the more you realize the truth, the less you get to enjoy your life, I don't want to sign up for that, is what people think. So they don't come to the sermons. I have a cousin who's like that as well. We used to be very close until I got ordained. And then no longer. It's very prominent in families. If any of you have someone who's ordained, I used to have some close relations in my family. And they have a very close relationship until you get ordained. Because then they fear. They get worried. Because sometimes they've seen the turmoil that's happened in the family. Right? As someone in the family wishes to go forth, and they go through the motions of convincing their loved ones, sometimes their parents, right, their siblings, the people they're going to be leaving behind. And you know, people who observe this, and they watch it, and then they begin to think, no, geez, I don't want to go through all that. It's such hardship and it's so straining and so stressful, and I don't want to go through that. But that's one part of it. The other side of it is they watch the journey that you have made, but not having gone through that journey. They don't go through the journey. They just stand by your side and watch you, and all they see is, you know, one day the guy goes enjoying his life, goes to the parties, goes to the musicals, goes to the gigs, right? And then goes to listen to a sermon. One sermon, two sermons, three sermons in, now he no longer wants to watch films. Now he doesn't want to go to the parties. He doesn't want to go to the gigs. He doesn't want to go to the cinema. They know a certain type of happiness. And this guy who goes to the sermons, he doesn't want that happiness. So the only happiness they know, this guy doesn't want it anymore. So then what does the Dhamma lead you to? Not freedom from suffering. From their lens, it's freedom from happiness. That's why I always urge you, don't let go of anything. One, in case it becomes painful for you, right? Bear this in mind for now and forever, ladies and gentlemen. This is one of the best pieces of advice I can give you. If whenever you let go of something, it is painful, you're not ready yet. So don't. Have you seen those serpents that shed their skin from time to time? It's a very natural process. They do it when they're ready for it. A caterpillar warps into a butterfly when it's ready for it, not prematurely. So if ever you listen to the talks, you listen to the sermons, and you feel, you know what, I want to become holier than I am today. I want to become more virtuous. And you decide you want to drop all the things that you've been doing. Now you start making a list. These are the things that I've been doing. Swami Nohansi says, you know, he let them go. He let go of all those things in his life. And so perhaps I should prepare myself for that. So you start making a list. cinema, going to the movies, no, cut that out. Friends, cut that out. Food, cut that out. Drinks, cut that out. Sport, cut that out. Reading books, cut that out. Playing the guitar, cut that out. I'm not asking you to live the life of a hermit. No. I'm actually making an invitation to you to enjoy life to its fullest. It's a very different thing. So, if ever letting go of whatever it is painful, and I'm not talking about the unmeritorious deeds, right? The bad stuff, the sinful deeds, let go of them whether you like it or not. The reason for that is because it's going to bite you on the back. Right? Those bad deeds will have their consequences. The bad stuff, you know, the Buddha laid them down very clearly, the 10 unmeritorious deeds. Killing, stealing, right, backstabbing, lying, all this stuff. Right? You know this stuff. Put that to a side, no questions about that. But the rest of it, your car, when is the time to let go of it? I used to have one. I used to like my car. I drove around in it, enjoyed it. I only let go of it when I was ready for it. When I let go of it, I didn't have, you know, I didn't even whinge about it. I didn't have just even the tiniest hesitance. Because when I let go of it, I was letting go of it for something bigger, something better, something greater. It's like when you eat. Your body knows when to let go of it. That's why you take yourself to the washroom when you're ready, but not any sooner than that. That example should make it come to life for you. Your body knows when the stuff that you put in through your mouth is ready to be thrown out the other end. Your body knows it. And that's when you take yourself there. In the same way, folks, don't ever let go of something you're not ready to. Because then it'll be painful. It'll hurt. And then you will begin to distance yourself from the Dhamma. That's what will happen. Because what is meant to heal you, if it hurts you, you will fall out of the Dhamma. Don't let that ever happen to you. Right? So, from time to time I'll remind you, don't let go. Just let it happen. I promise you, it will happen when you're ready for it. All you got to do is what? Continue to do your merits and bring yourself here. That's all I've asked you to do. Don't do any more than that. So, I say this because I've experienced this in my life. Right? The friends who used to be close to me, cousins, right? When they realized that I'd gone on to become a monk, they said they watched me, they grew up with me, they enjoyed the so-called good life with me, but then as they began to witness the change that was happening within me, they got very worried. They took a step back. They didn't like hanging out with me anymore because they thought, this association is not going to do us any good. So in your worldly, in your lay lives, no, just be very normal. Just be very, very normal. Please don't try to be abnormal. As a mother, just be a mother. Just be very normal at home. As a daughter, as a father, as a son, as a brother, sister, as a friend, just be very normal. Reflection is something you do in your own mind. Contemplation is something you do in your own mind. Nibbana doesn't happen with your arms and your legs. So do whatever you have to do. Play if you must, right? Do your work, go to your jobs, do whatever you have to do. If and when you feel you are ready to renounce your worldly life and go into robes, let me know. Then I will give you a different lecture so that you can prepare yourself for that. But until such time, as lay people who are living a lay life, there is a path to Nibbana for you as well. If I'm, you know, the rate at which we might progress might be different. Right? If you're cycling yourself to Nibbana, I'm on a rocket. It's about that. But cycling or on a rocket, you will eventually get to Nibbana. But let it come at its own pace. Everything must be done moderately. Even the Sura Mere Majjava Madhattana, right? The stuff that people tell themselves when they just want to be excused for their sins. So is ignorance bliss then? Don't worry, we'll discuss the Dhamma as well. And as we begin to learn the Dhamma, you will realize the answer to this question. But is ignorance bliss? Why do you suffer today? Is it because you know and understand, or because you don't know and you don't understand? When you see a flower, those flowers there, don't you think it's beautiful, that arrangement? Don't you think that flower arrangement is beautiful? It's pretty, isn't it? That is because of your ignorance. So then you say, but Swami Nasa, hold on a second. We are ignorant, fair enough, but it's beautiful. So that's bliss. So if you tell me that that is ignorance, and I somehow come out of my ignorance and become wise and understand the Dhamma, are you suggesting that I will no longer see the beauty in it? Why would I sign up for that deal? Sounds like a pretty foul deal to me, is what you might have to say. You will say this until you realize how beauty works in the mind. Let's talk about that today then. You've heard these things like beauty is only skin deep. There's another one. Beauty lies in the eyes of the beholder. Yeah? We're so accustomed to these sayings, but perhaps you've never stopped to wonder, well, what is the making of beauty? How does beauty happen? If you understand how beauty happens, you'll understand how beast happens. So beauty and the beast is the lesson for today. How does beauty happen? When you see beauty, why doesn't everyone see beauty the same way? Have you never wondered this question? Things that you think are nice, look good, they look good, they're pretty, they're beautiful, right? Whether it's a person, whether it's something, and you know, a material object. Right? Sometimes you're watching TV and you look at someone and go, wow, you know, she looks pretty, doesn't she? And everyone else in the room is going, you what? I remember from my school days, there's this, forgive me for saying this, I don't mean to offend or insult anyone, but it's just something I remember from my school days. I bring these things up because, you know, you are better able to relate to them, that's why, right? I'm a man of the earth, right? I didn't fall from the sky, right? So I share with you what I grew up with. You know, sometimes friends used to hang out together, right? And someone thinks that there's a girl that she really likes or he really likes, and he'll say, Machan, there's this girl I really like, right? I'll show you after school, right? So we hang out after school. I say, that one there. Which one? That one? No, the one behind her. Oh yeah, she's good. No, not that one, her sister. That one. And then we go, Appa, I have a post track. Now you're like, oh, but you used to say these things. And then you wonder, why? What makes you think that she's pretty? What makes you think that she's beautiful? You try to explain to them that she's not, and then he tries to explain to you, no, but she is. But we never wondered. You know, we thought something's wrong with the guy. Until you begin to realize how beauty actually works. How does the mind create beauty? Once you understand that, folks, you will begin to understand that it is so true that beauty only lays not in the eyes of the beholder, but in the mind of the beholder. And let me try and explain to you how beauty works then. There's such a thing called a drushti. A drushti is a view. Can you all hear me at the back? All right, good. There's such a thing called a drushti. A drushti is a perspective that the mind holds. It's the way we look at things. Okay, it's our opinion. You can think of it as an opinion. It's what the mind holds as true, what the mind bears as true. When the mind takes on a drishti, the drishti is the Sanskrit term, ditti is the Pali term, and dakma or drishtiya is the Sinhalese term. We can use view as the English term, view. So we have right view, wrong view, yeah? When the mind takes hold of a drishti, remember the mind is always looking for happiness. Yeah? The mind is always on the lookout for happiness because it is never fulfilled. Remember the pot with the hole at the bottom? Yeah, it's always looking for happiness. It's looking for the next opportunity in which it can satisfy itself. So a mind that is constantly on the lookout for an opportunity to please itself is always on the lookout for drishti. It's a bit like this. If you're a film fan or a music fan, you're always on the lookout for the next film, for the next album, right? For the next release, right? So sometimes, you know, you might read the magazines, you may go on the internet, you'll, you know, subscribe to maybe certain groups on Facebook, on social media, just waiting for the next thing to come out. And if a friend, if you, you might even have a little club that you have among your friends. You know, they have the book club, you have the film club, you have the music club. Right? And so in this circle of friends, what do? They find out what is good out there, the latest, the best, the greatest, and then they share it amongst the crowd. So the same thing happens with the mind. The mind is always on the lookout for the next opportunity to experience bliss. Have you never wondered why it is, when you grew up, right, as a young child, if you grew up in a family of two, where you were a boy and the other was a girl, or you have a sister or a brother, when you're young and your parents bring you toys, okay, what sort of toys are given to boys and what sort of toys are given to girls? Are they the same things? What do typically little girls, what do they get as a toy? Dolls. Boys, cars. Why? So a young girl, do you think she, have you ever heard a girl ask for a toy or a doll? They've never asked for one. It is what their parents gave them. Right at the beginning. That was the first toy. And if you walk into a girl's room, what color is it painted? Walk into a boy's room, what color is it painted? So do you think that this young girl, this infant of a girl, right, when she goes, ga ga, gu gu, what she actually means is paint my room pink? Do you think that's what she's saying? No. The kid doesn't understand. They don't know what color room they want. They don't understand pinks and blues. They just know they just see color, that's all. When they see color, they see color. But here's what happens. Here's why you grew up liking pink as women or girls, and here's why you grew up liking blue as men or boys. It's because that was your doctrination, your indoctrination. That was the drishti that was given to you right from your formative ages. You were programmed that way. See, like feeding a computer, right, from scratch. You came into this world and you were a formatted hard drive. And what your parents did, your teachers did, the people around you did, your friends did, the internet did, the magazines did, the TV did, was indoctrinating your mind one drishti at a time. So as a young girl, you'd have grown up looking around in your room. Most things were what color? Pink. As a boy, most things were blue. And when your parents were, I mean, you do this to your children, your parents did this to you. So, right? So it continues. from generation to generation, this continues. But then when the researchers, the scientists, they do a survey and they ask, you know, girls, what color do you like? And they say pink or a shade of it. And they think, well, girls must like pink. It must be something girlish. Perhaps it's in their DNA. It's not in their DNA. It's in the indoctrination. I remember the day I had to choose. I had to pick my favorite color. I remember that day very vividly. And I'll tell you the story. It was at my, when I was in school, I was very young, I think in grade 2. I know, actually much before that. I was in upper kindergarten. Yes. I had this bad habit of having my mouth open all the time. You know, some children are like that. So even if in my lectures in the classroom, I would always be like this. I just had a habit of keeping my mouth open. So one day, we were in this assembly, and the principal, it was a small school, it wasn't a big school, so the principal knew everyone in the school. And what the principal did was, while I was in the audience, in the assembly, she asked one of the teachers to give her a piece of paper. So they tore off a sheet of paper from a book and then passed it to the principal. She crushed that piece of paper and then she passed it down. Right down. So I could see the paper being passed down from one to the other to the other, and it was coming in my direction. So of course I was preparing myself to pass it back as soon as it came to me. But the moment it came in my hand, she said, "Stop." What do you think she had in mind for me? Yes. It was very embarrassing, but she taught me a lesson. I mean, she loved me. She doted on us. She was a wonderful teacher. But that was just her way of teaching me a lesson that I was never going to forget. You can know that from that day I never had my mouth open. So you're wondering, how did I pick my favorite color? So what happened is, I went to see the teacher, my principal after that, and she said, "Bring your parents. Ask your parents to come and meet me." For something else, but wasn't for that, but it was something else. And then I went to see my parents. My parents went into to school. Now, my parents had a problem with me. Now, they have lots of problems with me, but one of the problems they had with me was, at a young age, I was very untidy. I was very untidy. I would take off my clothes and just put them everywhere. I wouldn't clean up after me. I'm not like that anymore, I promise you. So here's what happened. So my mother, she wasn't fond of the fact that I'd come home and put all my clothes everywhere, because then she'd have to come and pick everything and put on the hangers, in the cupboard and all sorts. So she complained about this to the principal. And then the principal said, "Right, we need to sort this out, young man. From today onwards, I need you to be tidy, I need you to be neat, and I want you to hang your clothes in its rightful place after you head back from school." So she asked me a question. She spoke to my mother and she said, "Get this boy a hanger on which he can hang his clothes when he gets back home." And then she asked me a question, "What is your favorite color?" Because she wanted me to inform my mother in which color I wanted my hanger in. I remember, to this day, I didn't have an answer to that question. I honestly didn't have an answer to that question because I didn't have a favorite color. So when asked this question, "What is your favorite color?" I was gobsmacked. I didn't know what to say. I looked around the room and there was something that was red. And then I said, "My favorite color is red." So soon enough, I ended up with a hanger that was red. And then now my parents realized that my favorite color was red, because that is what I told them. And then they painted the whole room red. So my cupboard went red, my desk went red, and soon enough, I began to realize that my favorite color was red. So it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. I had to learn that my favorite color was red. Now, if you all have a favorite color, if you've had a favorite color, or if you still have a favorite color, I have to ask you the question, why? If yours is also red, why is red so special to you? Now, you'll all have a different favorite color. You know, some might say pink, others might say yellow, green, right? Purple, violet, brown, whatever, black, white. Now, you'll all have your own favorite colors. But if I ask you the question, why, do you have a valid answer to give me? An answer that will stand in a court of law. An answer which is truly valid. Why is red so virtuous? What is so bad about yellow? Why do we not like yellow? Why is yellow not your favorite color? And the biggest question of all, the most important question of all is, if you think red is such a pretty color, why doesn't everyone think so? So here's where we need to try and understand why it is that the mind picks up this drishti, and then from there on, it learns that these are the things in life that brings it happiness. So that is what we're going to try and find out now. How does beauty work? Why is it that then I grew up to learn and like red? And actually that remained with me for quite a long part of my life. I always thought, you know, red was my favorite color. It was something I had taught myself. And to explain that, I'm going to draw something on the board. See if you can try and make sense of this. All right? I was going to go for the red pen. And then I thought that was too much for one day. Would you agree that beauty has nothing to do with your body? When you perceive beauty, it has nothing to do with your body? Would you agree? Will you accept that? Okay. So although we say it lies in the eyes of the eye of the beholder, you know that it's not literally the eye of the beholder, right? It's in the mind of the beholder. Because if you swap this eye with another eye, nothing would have changed. You'd still like the same things. Okay? So then we are talking about the mind. This is a visual representation of a chitta. Any new faces today? Just give me a quick show of hands if you're new to the talk today, first day. Okay. All right. Welcome. Teruvan Sadhanai. This is a chitta. We represent a chitta in this way to explain the fact, to describe the fact that it arises and passes away. A chitta by its very nature, as anything, will arise and pass away. Now, we talked about manifestations, if you recall, from a few weeks ago. Right? So, a chitta manifests would be a better way of putting it. A chitta manifests. When the causes are present, those causes will result in a chitta coming into being. And so, what is a chitta again? You can think of it as a mind moment. Right? If you feel that your mind is forever there, right, just for the time being, if you feel that your mind is forever there, what I want to try and get across to you right now is, it's not something that's forever there. These are individual mind moments, one after the other, right? But they rise and fall in very quick succession, that you are unable to discern one mind moment from the next because they flow so rapidly. It's like when you watch a stream of water. If you didn't know that water was molecular, right, you'd think that this is just one thing, like flowing right from the mountains to the oceans, because it's all connected. So you'd think that this is like a piece of cloth, just very long. So the Mahavali is not one thing, it's just lots of drops of water. In the same way, although you sense that your mind is one thing and it's always been there from your birth and it's going to be there till your last moments, right? What it really is are individual thought moments that arise and pass away. Like the rain, for instance, right now. Although we say it's raining, these are actually individual drops of water, aren't they, that fall from the sky. But if you look outside, you'll see, you know, just a continuous stream of water. But actually what it is are individual drops of water. Now the same applies to chittas. Right, so now how does beauty happen then? In the chitta, there's a function called attachment. You'll know this as tanha. Now we're all very familiar with this word attachment or tanha, because we understand that this is the problem that we are all suffering from. Right? In every scripture you read, in every teaching that you hear, and every talk that is given, and every, you know that the Buddha's purpose in this world was to free ourselves and himself from tanha. We've heard the very popular saying, Dhammapada stanza, tanhai jayati soko, tanhai jayati bhaya, yeah, tanhai vipamuttasa, nati soko kuto bhaya. So if tanha is the cause of suffering, of fear, and tanha is the cause of grief, right, then where tanha has been exterminated, then where is grief and where is sorrow? Or where is fear? So you know that tanha is the problem here, tanha or attachment. For those who are still trying to get your heads around what attachment is, I want you to think of it as a function of the mind. See, this pen has a function. It can write. This fan has a function. There are multiple things, functions of this fan. One, it can be used as to cover myself up with. That's why when I drink some water, I can cover myself with this. For modesty. Then you can use it to cool yourself with. These are all functions. The microphone has a function. A chitta, when attachment exists in a chitta, the function of a chitta becomes attachment. So when a chitta attaches, I need you to understand of it as a function of a chitta. So it's a chitta need not always attach. It is optional. It doesn't have to attach. But when it does, it does. When a chitta arises, ladies and gentlemen, it always takes an object. A chitta can never arise without an object. Now, if you recall from a few talks ago, we talked about the various objects that a chitta can take. This is why we have our senses. Right, we have the eye, which gives the chitta an object. These are sight objects. Okay, so then of course we have the ear, that gives the chitta sound objects. We have the nose, which gives the ear smell objects. We have the tongue, can you still see that, okay? Up on the screen, which gives the chitta taste objects. And we have the sense of touch, and ultimately we have the mind itself. So I don't have a picture to draw the mind, so I just put a star here, because the mind does not have a form with which I can represent it. In fact, you could think the mind as the mind takes the form of the object that it takes. It's a bit like that. It's like the air in this room. What shape does it take? It takes the shape of the room, doesn't it? In a similar fashion, the mind takes the shape of the object which it has received. So anyhow, this takes thought objects. So sight, sound, smell, taste, touch and thoughts. These are the objects which a chitta takes, and without an object, there is no chitta. We can't talk about a chitta. And there's a reason for that. A chitta in itself is an instrument. Do you remember the Pali term? The verse that we used to describe this purpose of a chitta? In the same way, in the same manner, I could say, the purpose of a pen is to write. How might I say the purpose of a chitta? Aramanam vijanna lakkanam chittam. That is the Pali. In English, it would mean the purpose of a chitta is to receive, recognize. Come on. Remember? Register, right? So to receive, to register, to recognize, to respond, and to perceive. This is Rupa Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, and Vijnana. So once again, to receive, to register, to recognize, to respond, and to perceive. The chitta's purpose is to carry out these functions so that an object can be perceived. The reason that you know that I have a pen in my hand is because there's a chitta that's working inside these bodies that you have brought here. And these chittas, they're constantly working. Very rapidly. There is no gap between two chittas. There are no gaps. Just like in a stream of water, there are no gaps between two drops of water. Right? But if you take rain, for instance, you know, there will be gaps. But in a stream of water, a fast flowing stream of steady stream of water, there are no gaps between these drops. One after the other, right, they flow. And the mind is the same. And each of these thoughts, they arise with an object, because the whole purpose of a chitta is to do those five things about an object. So if there were no objects, why would there be chittas? Does that make sense to you? If there are no objects, why would there be chittas? It's like reception. The reception desk at a hotel, in an office. If there are no visitors, why would you have a reception desk? Makes sense, right? So in the same way, if there are no objects, then there would not be a chitta. Right. So let's take a sight object then. So I was talking about the flower. Why is it that this flower is beautiful? Let's take a sight object. So here's the eye. It's seen the flower. Okay. And now we talked about this some time ago, that the brain is involved in all this. So I'm not going to go into the detail of that for today. Somehow, with the help of the brain, these impulses that have arrived through the eye are converted to a language that the mind can interpret. And we call them rupa. We call them rupa. So this is why you may have heard of rupa rupa, shabda rupa, gandha rupa, rasa rupa, sparsha rupa, dhamma rupa, or pottabha rupa. Yeah? So this is rupa rupa. In other words, sight objects. See, when we talk about an object, ladies and gentlemen, what that object is depends on which circumstance we're talking about. These things are also objects. See, this is an object. The leaf in my hand is an object. These are material objects. They have a weight. They have mass. They have length, they have width, they have breadth. Here's a question for you. What about color? Does it have color? I can see heads nodding in both directions. Some going yes, some going no. Does this leaf have color? Yes? No? Maybe not diagonally? Just to be on the safe side? So it has mass, right? And in gravity it has weight. It has length, it has breadth, it has width, right? But it doesn't have color. It has pigments, but it doesn't have color. This leaf appears green to you not because the leaf is green. It's got chlorophyll, which is a pigment. And what that pigment does is it takes in light energy, absorbs some of it, and reflects the rest of it. The rest of the light that gets reflected fall on your eye. It's not green yet, by the way. It's just light energy of a certain frequency. It then goes up your optic nerve, at which point it's an electrical current. You can't talk about the color of an electrical current, can you? See, if this leaf had color, the point at which the sight becomes a signal on an optic nerve, you're going to have to stop talking about color, wouldn't you? You can't talk about color at that point. Even if you could say that color is in the leaf, right? And then even if you could say that the color meets the eye, it falls on the retina, and then you'll say, yes, but Swaminathan, so we have the cone cells and the rod cells, right? The color falls on the cone cells, and then you have the fovea on which, right, the eye focuses. So surely that's where color happens. All right, but what about the optic nerve then? Have you seen nerves carry colors? Well, then do nerves carry smells? So much so that if you were to slice the optic nerve and look at it, would you see green? If I held an eye, a human eye, to this leaf, right, just up here, and I took the optic nerve that belonged to the eye, and then cut it, severed it so that it no longer goes to the brain, when I looked at the eye, at the optic nerve, the fibers that go to the optic nerve, through to the brain, would it show me green? What do you think? Would it? No. But if I held it to a voltmeter, am I not going to get a reading? Yes. So what's in it? Is it color or is it current? It's an electrical current. What color is electrical current then? If electrical current were green, then none of these lights would be the colors they are. They would all be green. Then tell me, is green in this? Is green in the leaf? No, green's not in the leaf. But you look at the flower and go, oh, pink flowers, so pretty. I'm sharing these things with you so that you don't have to let go. When you understand the Dhamma, you will no longer need to let go. That letting go will have happened. Letting go has to be natural, not forceful. Once you understand that all these things that you attributed to the physical and material things, right? You looked at, say, two pictures. One was red, the other was green. Your favorite color was red, so therefore you bought the red picture. Perhaps you paid $1 million for it. Think about art for a second. Right? I mean, if I drew this, you wouldn't pay anything for that. But if Picasso drew that, if Michelangelo drew that, you'd exchange that for your house. There's a professor, what's his name? Do you remember his name? So there's a professor from Yale University. He's a professor in psychology. Now, I don't think he's discovered Buddhist philosophy yet. Certainly not the philosophy that we are talking about today. But he's beginning to make some headway in terms of trying to figure that, you know, this beauty that we assume is in the objects is not in the objects. In one of the sermons at the monastery, I talked about this. And for the life of me, I can't remember his name now. But he's a very renowned professor from Yale University. And he asks the question, a bit of bubble gum, how much would you pay for a bit of gum? If you went to the shop today and you bought some gum, right, bubble gum, how much would you pay for that? 500 rupees? No. 50? No. 10 bucks? Okay. Maybe. So the professor in his talk, he speaks of a bubble gum that is worth more than $300. Do you know why? Britney Spears chewed on it. I'm not making this stuff up. The same gum, apparently she chewed on it, and then she spat it out. $300. How much would you pay for a jumper? You know, a jacket? So again, he asked this question. Like one jumper in a store, $25. Rooney wore it. And then, $25,000. How much would Michael Jackson's shoes cost you? Or his iconic hat? So, what about the object has changed? Nothing about the object has changed. It's only our perception. You know, your perception does so much damage to your lives. And this is why I'm trying to explain this to you, so that you can come out of this misery, come out of this slavery. The way you perceive, your misperceptions have completely ruined your lives. So this is an opportunity to come out of that. When the mind takes an object, now I'm speaking to you about the mind of an arahant, okay? This thought, or this mind, this chitta, it perceives this object, so it does the five things, receive, register, recognize, respond, and perceive. Okay, so I'm just going to call it the five aggregates, all right? The chitta functions on this object as it rises and passes away. So at the end of this chitta, what has happened in this world? What do you think has happened in this world? Nothing, just apart from one thing. Oh, five things if you like. An object has been received, it has been registered, it has been recognized, it has been responded to, and it has been perceived. That is all that has happened. Nothing more, nothing less. If you were all arahants, ladies and gentlemen, that is all that would happen when I show you that flower. You would receive it, you would register it, you would recognize it, you would respond to it, and you would perceive it. That's it. But that doesn't stop there, does it? Because for you, you see beauty. There may be even some in the audience who might look at that and go, "That's actually, Swaminas, that's not pretty. For me, that's pretty ugly, actually. I don't like that. It's not to my taste. That's not my type." Then, I mean, just look at the shades. You know, they don't even blend. Some might say that. So here's how that happens then. When the chitta arises, if the chitta arises on a base of ignorance, okay, so I dropped that word there, ignorance, for a second, and I'll explain to you further what that means, because you're asking the question, is ignorance bliss? As the chitta arises on a base of ignorance, this chitta, it already perceives this object in a, or rather, it knows a thing or two about this object already. At least it thinks it knows. It thinks it knows. Here's what it thinks it knows. It thinks that beauty is in the object. It thinks. This is a false view. Or mitya ditti. A false view. There are right views and there are false views. When the chitta takes a false view and it accepts it. Now, have you never fallen prey to this? I'm not talking about, you know, beauty. False views. Have you never been cheated on? I don't mean necessarily, you know, from a loved one, but, you know, by a friend maybe. Right? Being cheated. Lied to. You fell for it, didn't you? When someone's lied to you, you've been on the receiving end of that. Is that not a misperception? Is that not a misunderstanding of the facts? Is that not a misunderstanding of reality? See, how easily the mind can be fooled. Next week, if I can, I'll bring you a few video clips. These are adverts that have been done to... What was it for? It was for an insurance company. They're very popular. I think you may have seen them on YouTube. Have you heard of an insurance company called America Quest? I'll bring them in for next week. In these videos, I'll describe one video to you so you understand how the mind can be fooled. Okay? So, there's a man who's at home. He's come home from work and he's preparing some dinner for his other half. So the wife, she goes just from shopping and she's got her shopping with her. She's come up to the door. So this is what they show us on this advert. And this man, you know, he's preparing something. I think he's making some pasta and some tomato puree to go with that. So, of course, the tomato puree is what color? Red. Yeah? So while he's preparing this, the cat comes up to him. This is the domestic, the pet cat. So the cat just, you know, walks around his legs, you know, he's just trying to play with this guy, and the cat jumps onto the pantry. Now this guy, he's got the dish that he's preparing, and then the cat on the other side. And then what happens is the cat jumps, and when the cat jumps, it bumps into this thing that he's making, and it drops on the floor. So now where's the tomato puree? It's on the floor. And this guy, all the while, he holds a knife in his hand because he's trying to chop some vegetables or some, you know, for dinner. So now there's the tomato puree on the floor, there's a knife in his hand, and the cat has now just made a mess. So he holds the cat in his hand with the knife in the other hand, then there's something red on the floor, and the wife walks in. So when the wife walks in, what does she see? What does she think now? She thinks this man is has his way with the cat. She thinks that he's killed the cat, or at least trying to kill the cat. Now, this is a pure misconception, is it not? Complete misconception. There's one thing that's really going on, but something else is being perceived. So, this is proof that the mind can be conned. Right? So the mind can be fooled. And that's just one example. There are plenty of those videos. I'll bring them in for next week so you can just get an understanding. I mean, it'll be a bit of a laugh, but that's not the point of it. What I want you to see is how easily the mind can be fooled. And the reason that the mind can be fooled, ladies and gentlemen, is because the mind just can, you know, it can take any drishti. And the mind does not stop to think whether this drishti that I'm taking on is right or wrong. If it takes it, it takes it. Let me give you another analogy to this. Take a sponge and put it into pure water. What does it do? It absorbs the water. Put it into dirty water. What does it do? It absorbs the dirty water. Because that is how a sponge works. It absorbs whatever the liquid it is in. Now, in the same way, the mind absorbs whatever the drishti it is that is given to it, unless it already holds a drishti that is stronger than the one that is trying to be fed. That is why once you become a sotapanna, you can no longer be fed nonsense about this world, about the world being pleasurable. Because once you become a sotapanna, your drishti is purified. It is cleared. You take on the drishti of samma, samma drishti. You take on the drishti of anicca, dukkha and anatta. Once you take these three drishti, the characteristics of all things in this world, all manifestations in this world, once you absorb that drishti in your mind, nothing can topple that. Because whatever drishti you have, you always compare it with whatever is coming in. That's how it works. Right? Before you throw something out, right? It's like, you know, when you do the shopping. Right, and you walk up to your fridge because you have to put the shopping into your fridge. You open the cupboards. Yeah, you look at what is old, what's gone off. Right, what must you throw out before you put the good stuff in? Right, if there's something that has a closer expiry date, right, you might throw that out and put the new stuff in. So there's always a comparison. So in the same way, ladies and gentlemen, when a drishti comes your way, you will only accept it if it is stronger than the drishti that you already have. Let me prove that to you with one more example, which this is a strong example. It might sound a bit hard, but it is true. Why do you not have, although you know, you may have feelings towards members of the other gender, why do you not have those feelings towards members of your family? Because those views are very strongly and firmly held in your mind. This is my sister, this is my mother, this is my aunt, this is my cousin. And at, you know, towards them, you have devotion, you have affection, a different kind of affection. But let's just say, you didn't know that your sister was your sister. Biologically you were, brothers and sisters, but you didn't know this. I mean, you watch this stuff on films all the time. Right? Later on they realized that they were actually blood relations, but they didn't know it until then. You have, you know, films, you watch this stuff. Say, you know, the baby got swapped in the hospital by mistake. And then later on they realized that actually, you know, this is your sister. And the moment you realize, this is my sister, all those feelings that you had, I'm just trying to get you to imagine, you know, an extreme example. I'm sorry to bring this example up, but it proves the point. When there are views that you hold very firmly in your mind, those views cannot be moved. They are firm, they are solid, they are rock solid. Just like the drishti of a sotapanna. Once it takes root, there is no removing it. That is why our objective of all this is to try and have that rooted in your mind. If that happens to you at any point, then from there on, I'm okay with you associating anyone in this world, because they will no longer be able to put all sorts of rubbish indoctrinations into your mind. But until such time, rubbish indoctrinations, nonsensical indoctrinations can be put into your mind, such as, this flower is beautiful. It is a lie. It is not true. When someone says, this flower is pretty, your mind accepts this, because the mind is always looking for happiness. What is beauty if not a version of happiness? See, I'm trying to explain to you now why the mind looks for beauty. Why you're always on the lookout for beauty. Really, it's not beauty that you're trying to look out for. It's not beauty you need. What you're looking for is happiness. Give me the common, what is common about these words? I'm going to give you a few words and tell me what's common about them. Okay? Beautiful. Tasty. Pleasant. Sweet. What is common about some of these words? Actually, most of these words. They bring with them the promise of happiness, does it not? When I say beautiful, you understand that it is the way that the eye pleases the mind. Beautiful. When I say tasty, delicious, you understand that as the way the tongue pleases the mind. Does that make sense to everyone? Are you all with me here? If it doesn't make sense, just put your hand up. Excellent, right. So, tasty is when we say how the tongue makes the mind happy. And beautiful is when we say how the eye makes the mind happy. Okay? So, what the mind's looking for is not either tasty or beauty. What it's looking for is actually happiness. But happiness we express in lots of different terms, especially when we talk about the way the mind interacts with the sensual objects in the world outside. We have different words to describe that. So if it's sound, for example, we might say melodious. That's very melodious. It's very nice, very sonorous, you might say. Meaning it's very pleasing on the ear. Right? When someone sings, oh, it's lovely. She, you know, she has a lovely voice. What you're really saying is, the mind is now happy. These objects, these sense objects that you have, ladies and gentlemen, you know, they are constantly dumping the mind with stuff. Not for any other reason than the mind wishing to achieve a sense of happiness. You enjoy a sense of bliss. But that bliss is because of your ignorance. Because you believe that these objects on the outside, the sights, the sounds, the smells, the tastes, all this stuff, they have inherently beauty, tastefulness, sonorousness, or melodiousness, right? These are things that are inherent in these material objects. So you're constantly, you know, these radars are open to the external world, constantly trying to absorb things from the outside in a quest to satisfy the mind. So because the mind is always expecting happiness to come from the outside, it's always hopeful. So when the mind takes this drishti, that I'll take this flower, I mean. When the mind is hopeful that this flower has beauty, you actually look at it expecting beauty. Let me say that again. When you look at this object with the prior knowledge or drishti, this view that there is beauty in a flower, now you look at this flower expecting the flower to deliver what? Beauty. You expect the flower to deliver that. So you look at it and you see beauty. Really, beauty is something you project onto the outside world. Now your mind goes into a state of vexation. We've talked about this word briefly in the previous talks. Vexation. Vexation is where the mind longs for something. It goes into a state of longing. It goes into a state of, it goes into a void. It goes into a state, it's like a vacuum, expecting it to be satisfied. A state of unsatisfactoriness, a state of unfulfillment, expecting to be fulfilled, expecting to be satisfied. When presented with this object, that gap is filled. That void is filled. And when that void is filled, your mind is now relieved from that tension, that vexation that it was once in. Now, I see some blank faces in the audience, and that's perfectly fine. This is typical. Okay? This is typical. So not to worry. I just want you to hang in there. I'll give you 100 examples and explain this to you in a million different ways until the penny drops. All you got to do is just hang in there. You know, I don't expect any of this to make sense to you immediately because you've lived an entire samsara knowing and practicing the complete opposite of what I'm trying to explain to you. It's like me telling you this is a blackboard. Why would you take me on the first word you hear? This is not a blackboard. You're saying this is a whiteboard. So I mean, no, this has always been a whiteboard. Why are you telling me it's a blackboard? Exactly. It's much the same way. So when I tell you that there's no beauty in this flower, thankfully you've heard these phrases like beauty is in the eye of the beholder, it's only skin deep, right? So your teachers have done half the job for me, as we learned growing up, right? But to actually internalize this understanding, it's going to take a while. It's all right. Hang in there. So please don't leave today's talk thinking, until now we understood everything, but today I'm completely at a loss. I thought I understood Buddhism, but now I realize I don't understand a single bit of Buddhism. It's not so. You need to allow time to do this. You know, this is like cooking. You just got to give it time. Just put it on the fire. Let it simmer. It'll happen. Let me try this again. I'll try it again and again and again and again. I don't get exhausted. Don't you worry. Let's try it again. There is no beauty in this flower. Before that, let me give you another example. I think that will help. Think of the last time you lost something. Not your marbles. Think of the last time you lost something. Maybe a bunch of keys, maybe your spectacles, right? Maybe your wife, whatever. You lost something. Right? No, not lost in that way, like, you know, actually temporarily. Okay? You lost something, right? And now you want it back. I remember when I lost my keys. That memory really stuck with me because I wanted my keys to go to a Dhamma talk, and without my keys I couldn't get into my car, and that is why that memory stuck with me. But I've lost plenty of things, right? But that memory has really stuck with me. Think of a time where you really lost something, something that was dear to you, something that was precious to you. Okay? Now, whatever you're thinking of, I'll give you one example and you can apply that into your own examples. When I lost my keys that day, I walked around the house looking for it. So, you know, you look in the obvious places first. You look in the cupboards, you look in the drawers, you know, you look on the desk, you look under the desk, and then after a while you start looking in the, you know, in between the sofa, under the sofa, in the fridge, just in case. You never know when or where it might end up. Then you look in the stove, you look in the oven, you look everywhere, right? So I was desperate. I was desperately looking for my keys. And eventually, my wife brings the keys and says, "Here they are." So she'd found them under the car. How did it get under the car? Because I'd left the keys under the car to pick up the shopping. I mean, we'd just come back from shopping, and then that's where I had left the keys. So anyhow, she brings the keys after several hours of me looking for them. Now, in the first few moments, I was not so stressed. But what happens as time progresses, right, over time, and you really need it, if you can't give up looking for it, what happens to your mind? You get more and more vexatious, right? You get really stressed out. Just imagine if you lost your child for a second. I don't mean dead. I mean like actually lost. Right? So maybe you're out doing some shopping and the child runs away in the supermarket. Right? He just lets go of your hand and he runs away. Now, as a mother, how would you feel about that situation? I mean, you'd be walking around like like a headless chicken, wouldn't you? Where's my child? Where's my child? You know, knocking from door to door, screaming out loud if you must. And you'd be really desperate looking for your child. And the longer that passes, remember when, was it Madeleine McCann? The young girl that was lost? Yeah, yeah. So remember, it became a worldwide, you know, it became a thing all over the world. And everyone was looking for Madeleine. But of course, most of all, her parents were. Because when something's dear to you, when something is so precious to you, and you lose it, you almost feel like, you know, your life is lost, and you need it back. Now, here's what happened when I found my keys. So my wife brought them back to me, and then she showed them to me, and go, "Here you go." I'd never been so happy to see my keys. Never in my life, not even the day I bought my car and held my keys in my hand for the first time, not even on that day was I so happy to see my keys. But on that day, when she showed me those keys, I was so happy. I was over the moon. But here's the deal. Those same keys, you know, that bunch of keys, had I not seen them before? Had I not seen them on the table? Had I not seen them on the key hanger? Plenty of times. But why did it not make me so happy when I saw them all those times? But it sent me into a state of euphoria when I saw it after I had lost it. Why so? Why so? Vexation. It's vexation. Now, my wife was asking me the other day, by other day I don't mean yesterday, back then, right? So, a few weeks after my birthday came up, and then she was saying, "Honey, I've never seen you happier than when I saw you, the look on your face when you saw those keys. So for your next birthday, I was thinking of maybe giving you a bunch of keys as a birthday gift." Would she be right to do so? No, but would, you know, she makes a point, doesn't she? But you know that it's not a valid point. Because you know that it was not the keys that made me happy. It was me longing for it. It was me vexing for it. So this is why the saying goes, absence, yes, makes the heart grow fonder. So if absence makes the heart grow fonder, then what must you do with all the things you like and you love? Yes. Come on, Pingatuni. If absence makes the heart grow fonder, then of course, come and live with me for a few weeks. You'll be absent from all the things that makes your heart grow fonder. And then after you return home for in about a year or two, right? You'll be delighted. Now you've got to think, why does absent makes the heart grow fonder? It's because when the mind is vexed, the mind looks for release from vex. It looks for relief. So when you are relieved from that, would it not be flawed thinking if one were to think that the object of pleasure or the source of pleasure was the object? Don't you think it would be flawed thinking? Take the example of the keys again. If the keys were the source of my pleasure, would I not have had the same pleasure as I did on the day where my wife brought those keys back and said, honey, here you go. Would I not have had the same pleasure every time I saw those keys? I should have, shouldn't I? But did I? Certainly not. That being the case, don't you think we have to come to a conclusion that pleasure was not in the keys, just as much as it is not in this flower? But you think this flower is beautiful. You think beauty is in the flower. I tell you, beauty is not in the flower. But how then does beauty happen? How then do you see beauty? Here's how. The same phenomenon. It's the same principle. That very principle of how I was able to relieve myself from vexation when I saw those keys that were returned to me, you look at this flower and you see beauty. This is why, folks, keep staring at this all day long, and what's going to happen? Yes, the flower is going to wither away, but not just that. Let's say we made it out of plastic. And I asked you to look at it all day long. After a while, you're going to say, haven't you got anything else? It's not so pretty now. It's not so beautiful now. Because you get accustomed to it. You familiarize yourself with it. Right? Contentment. Right? This is what begins to happen. As you associate with something more and more and more, it breeds contempt. Familiarity, that's the saying. Familiarity breeds contempt. So as you become familiar with something, you no longer have those positive feelings about it. You no longer experience pleasure from it. What you begin to experience is contempt for it. It becomes tasteless. Have you never wondered why the same thing when you keep eating, you lose the deliciousness of it? See, here's the science behind it. Here's the mental science behind it. The first bite you take is what? Ambrosia. Second bite, less so. Third bite, less so. I remember when I was a young lad, you know, going to university, right? We used to save up and go to a buffet. The Chinese buffets, you know, Indian buffets, you know, when we were there, you know, that's what we used to do, eat. But I remember what we used to do was, friends and I, you know, if we knew that we had a buffet, we were planning to go out and eat, for this evening, we would skip lunch altogether. Cup of tea and a sandwich for breakfast, that would do. Skip lunch, skip evening meals, whatever. And because, when you go to a buffet, you have to eat. You have to eat as much as you can. And one, you know to get your money's worth, right? Because, you know, I used to do my job, you know, odd jobs, you know, saving up, right? To do all sorts. You know, my parents wanted me to do that because they wanted me to have that experience of earning for myself from a young age. They wanted me to understand where money comes from. So although they could afford everything I wanted, they wanted me to experience that. So in those countries, people get that experience, and I was fortunate to have that. So whatever money I had to go out and eat was money that I had earned for myself. And so when you spend that money, you want your money's worth. So we used to save up for that, and we used to skip those meals because once you go into the buffet, you can eat as much as you can. Now, once you walk into the restaurant and you see all these lovely dishes laid out, right, it's a cuisine galore, isn't it? Like you walk into a buffet, there's Chinese and Mongolian and Japanese and duck, right, and all sorts, right? 10 different types of rice and 600 different types of noodles, right, and all sorts of different foods. So ice cream and the chocolate fountain, everything. Everything you could hope for and everything you could imagine. So we sat there, right, with a plate in hand, now expecting to eat to our heart's content. But unfortunately, only the first few mouthfuls were so delicious. I remember when I started stuffing myself, the first few mouths, they went in at the speed of light. One, I was hungry, and two, it tasted so delicious. But the third, fourth, fifth mouthful, by the time I was going for my second servings, not so. You've experienced this. When you eat something, although it's so delicious, that's why your home cooking is not so good. But, you know, you have a visitor. My mother makes a cake. She feeds it to her child, and the child says, "Thank you, Amma." But, you know, you have a visitor, the child from next door. He comes around and you give her the same cake, and, you know, he loves you for it. And then you say, "See, what's the point of cooking for you people? The child next door, they appreciate my cooking." No, the only thing is, you know, familiarity breeds contempt. That's what's happening. Because the more you have something, the less the mind vexes for it. What I need you to understand, folks, is you're not experiencing pleasure in the object. You're experiencing a pleasure that comes through the relief from vexation. This is both physically and mentally true. We did this experiment when we first started doing these talks a few weeks ago, maybe a couple of months ago even. Right? I asked you to bend your finger backwards, remember? Right? And the more you bend, the more it hurts, but the more you bend it and let go, the better you feel. Because if you only just tug it just a little bit and let go, you don't feel, there's no pain to relieve from. But if you pull it all the way back and hold it there until you can hold it no longer, and it becomes excruciatingly painful, now you let go and you experience such relief. It's like when you go do your shopping and you bring your shopping bags and you let it, you know, let go of it, let it, put it down or put it into your boot, right, after you've done all the shopping round and you go. It's a sigh of relief. On a hot day and you take a cool glass of water, it's very relieving. But on a cool day and you take a hot mug of tea, it's relieving. So don't you think that it is meaningless to attribute pleasure to the physical object? It's not the object that gives you pleasure then. It is your longing for it. So how again do you see beauty then? Your longing for this is what makes this beautiful in your mind. That is why, you know, in relationships, right, you know, when we speak to, when people come up to us and ask for relationship advice, they do that as well. And out of compassion, we teach them the Dhamma. That's what we do, actually. We teach them the Dhamma. We explain this concept to them. We explain to them, Mahatya, after a while, your wife is not going to look so beautiful to you. You know, we give them the you know, this is a prophecy. Like we tell them what's coming. It's better to be prepared for it, right? And we tell the lady as well, Nona, after a while, Mahatya is not going to look so handsome. Prepare yourself for it. How do you prepare for it? We then advise him, don't fall in love for their appearance. Because appearance, you will not find it pleasurable for very long. Get to know them. Understand them. Get to know them as a human being. Get to know them, what they're like, you know, what their temperament is like, what they are like as a human being. Familiarize yourself with their kindness, the gentleness, generosity, and things like that. Don't fall for the appearance, because the appearance, the luster of the appearance, will only last for a very short period of time. Why again? Familiarity breeds contempt. This is why, although in some relationships, folks, you know, when, you know, sometimes you might see this, you know, a lady in a relationship and you think, oh, she's so pretty. Why does a man, you know, not look after her? Why is she neglected? How come, you know, they can neglect someone so good looking? She's like a goddess. Yeah, to you, yes. Because you've only just seen her. But ask the guy who lives with her every day. I'm not saying because of her weaknesses, not because of her flaws. You know, she might actually be a goddess. In her behaviors, in her characteristics, she might actually be. But I'm talking about the looks. These looks are purely, you know, the way a face is constructed is the way the face is constructed. God never put beauty into anything. There's no beauty in any of this. The skin is taut, yes. The nose is in the right position, yes. The eyes are perfectly symmetrical, yes. The lips are symmetrical, they're plump, yes. All of these things are physical attributes. But beauty? No. No. Is she fair? Yes. But not because she's of fair color, but there are fewer pigments. There's less melanin on the skin. Therefore, yes. It's characteristic, it's objective. But beauty? Not objective. That's subjective. You know, that's why I see this a lot of the time. But you try and explain this to people, and if they only took on this advice, you know, people will be able to live a happier life together. Excuse me. Because what we see a lot these days, folks, is people fall for appearances first, and then they get to know the person. Sometimes they've already tied the knot, started living together, and it was all, you know, on the face of appearance. But later on, they begin to learn and realize that, you know, I can't live with this person, and then they split up. Because the appearance, this good-looking appearance, you know, it only lasts for a very short period of time. I've seen people who would not let go of their partner's hand. They'll walk up and down the streets, you know, walk along the beaches, right, go places, and all the while holding hands. But after a while, they start living together, and the sunglasses come on. And it's sunset. Why do you need sunglasses at that time? Because when you put the sunglasses on, you can't see where else he's looking. That's why. I'm not saying always. I'm not saying, you know, that is why they always put the sunglasses on. But what I'm saying is, sunglasses do come on. So that you can hold the hand, but look at what other options might be available. That's why we say don't fall for appearance. You know, I think this is what young people should be taught before they're allowed to get married. Don't fall for the looks. It's not the looks that you should be going for. Understand who they are as a person. Do they have the characteristics? Do they have the qualities that you can live with? Are they virtuous? Do they conduct themselves in a good manner? Like whatever it is you need to be able to live comfortably, can she cook? Can he do a job? Right? These are the things you need to look for. Looks, you know, very superficial. They'll only last for a very short time. But you know, in the world that we live in today, you know, there is more value given to how a person looks than who they are deep down. Don't you agree? Everything is glamour. It's just the glamour on the outside. As long as the shell looks fine, even if it's empty on the inside, I'll take it home. It's a pitiful state, but that's what people have fallen into. Here's the explanation behind all this. When the mind goes into a state of vexation, the mind, it's just about arising right now. Okay? So, we've shown the flower, and the mind is just about to arise in this point. Okay? But the chitta, or the mind, holds this opinion, this belief that beauty is in the flower. Okay? So, it believes that the beauty is in the flower. And then it's longing for that beauty. It's longing for pleasure. Whilst it's longing for pleasure, the chitta arises. This is just like, a surge of energy. This is what it is, a surge of energy. So the object is presented. Optical nerve, brain, drops the rupa on the mind base, or the mind faculty. Yeah? But it is ridden with ignorance. And what is ignorance again? That beauty is present in the object. With that expectation, the mind now begins to receive, register, recognize, respond, and perceive. With that expectation. Expectation of what? That beauty is in the object. So then here's what happens. With that expectation, the receiving process starts. So this is where the process is kicked off. Receiving happens. So the rupa is received at the mind. With the expectation that beauty is in the flower. It has been longing for this rupa and the rupa has just arrived. It's like when you wait for your delivery. The longer you wait, the more pleasurable it is. So as the mind has now been waiting for this rupa, as it has just arrived, the mind goes from a state of vexation to a state of relief. It is that relief you now begin to experience as beauty. You call it beauty because it is an object that has come through the eye. If it is an object that came through the tongue, you would not call it beauty, you just call it tasty. Let's just say, instead of plugging this wire, this nerve that goes from the eye to the brain, instead of plugging it to the optic center, let's imagine you plugged it to the taste center, which is apparently somewhere around here in the brain. Then, when a flower is put forward or presented to your eye, you'll probably go, that tastes nice. Because it is neither deliciousness nor beauty that you're experiencing. These are all creations of the mind. Why creations of the mind? The mind goes into vexation and it is relieved from vexation. Does this concept of vexation, is it beginning to make sense to you? I need you to understand this before we progress any further. That's why the best way to explain this to you and to get you to understand this is through these examples. That's why I'm throwing you an innumerable examples so you can grasp this concept. That's why I say, on a hot day, a cool glass of water. But on a cold day, a hot mug of tea. If it is a cool glass of water that gives you happiness, why don't we drink it all the time? If it's a hot mug of tea that makes you happy, why don't we drink it all the time? Now, you see, it's a bit cool in here, right? A bit cold in here. Maybe a bit. Perhaps some of you are feeling a bit chilly. If we brought in some, soft drinks, chilled soft drinks, how many of you would be happy to indulge in one of those? Probably none of you. But if you brought in maybe a warm glass of water or maybe a hot cup of tea, right? Now you'll be happy. But if it's a hot day, so then I have to ask the question, which one makes you happy? Is it the cool glass of water or the hot mug of tea? Which one makes you happy? Now you have to say, Swami Nahansan, neither of them makes me happy. It depends on the circumstance in which I am in. Do you agree with that? It depends on the circumstance in which you are in. If you are feeling hot, then the cool glass of water is your remedy. If you are feeling cold, then the hot mug of tea is your remedy. Neither of them inherently have happiness or pleasure in them. But they are both capable of giving you what you lack. So when this void that you have is filled, now you feel a sense of relief. And that is the sense of relief that you experience as pleasure. That is why we say pleasure is so overrated. But people fall for it, this stuff. You know, if I said, like, this flower, if I could really convince you that this flower was so beautiful, and I can, you know, all I have to do is indoctrinate you. I mean, you just think about why some people pay lots of money, like, for art. I mean, what is art after all? Just think about it. I've got nothing against artists or people who are collectors of art, right? You carry on doing what you have to do. That's fine. I just want you to think intelligently. Because you all deserve to think intelligently. That is why I make this invitation. Think about art for a second. A few lines. Straight lines, curved lines, shapes, right? Colors, a mix of colors, a blend of colors. If you just think about the colors themselves, you know, what will you have? The colors of the rainbow. And some lines drawn in pencil. What makes that piece of art so expensive? What makes it so expensive? What is expensive about the art? Is it the paint? Is it the canvas? Is it the frame? What is it? This is just paint. In the same paint you can go and buy at a shop. You could buy the whole shop. For the price you might pay for one piece of art, you could buy the whole shop. So why is art precious? And if there are any artists in the room, then please forgive me. But I need you to open your eyes and wake up from your dreams. Because you fall for it otherwise. This is the truth about the world. This is the truth about existence. Because if you fall into this trap, then people get to call the shots. Now you become slaves. So then people get to demand. I don't like it when people demand in front of you. Because that is an insult to the Buddha. If the Buddha, you know, if I'm a disciple of the Buddha, right? Let's just think about this for a second, folks. If I claim to be a disciple of the Buddha, and a woman could come up to me and then dare me and says, "Swami Mohan sir, are you a disciple of the Buddha?" I say, "Yes, madam, I'm a disciple of the Buddha." And she says, "Oh, really? Would you like to come over for lunch?" If I'm so weak to fall for that, don't you think that is the biggest insult to the Buddha? And to his teaching? You know, when the Buddha attained Buddhahood, Mara, having been defeated, sent his three daughters, Tanha, Rati and Raga. It is said that they are the epitome of beauty. There is nothing more beautiful than that. They came and they did their dances. They came and they did all sorts of things to indulge him, to try and lure him into a state of intoxication, sensual intoxication. But none of that worked. It was not because he was patiently trying to fight it all. Not so. Desire did not ignite within him. He had completely extinguished that. He could no longer be vexed. Because he could no longer be vexed, he did not see beauty. The Buddha does not see beauty. But he understands how people see beauty. So if you go to the Buddha and ask the Buddha, "Venerable sir, this flower arrangement that these devotees have put together, don't you think it's beautiful?" The Buddha will say, "Yes, I think it is beautiful." Absolutely, he would answer that. And in fact, he might even advise on how to arrange these flowers in a way that would look beautiful. Because he understands how beauty works in the mind, of, you know, in people's minds. So therefore, he's able to give you that instruction. It's like, you know, when you play with your kids, like when you play, when you play like toy house, like with your kids, right? And they want to be mother, and the son wants to be the father, right? And then they have a kitchen, and they have a living room, they have a bedroom, right? All in their own room, right? And you go make believe that, you know, they are the householders, and they are, you know, they do the cooking and the cleaning and the sweeping and all that, right? Now you know that this is only a pretense. This is a playhouse. In a playhouse, as an adult, you know that it is just a play. But to the kid, it's the real deal, isn't it? They really enjoy it. For them, it's the real thing. So you don't tell a kid, hey kid, this is a playhouse. Come on, dude. What are you, a kid? You don't tell the kid that, because the kid is a kid. So to the kid, you know, a playhouse is a real thing. They enjoy it just as much as you do in your real house. Now who's the kid? Just as much as you enjoy doing your interior decoration, right, painting the walls and doing the upholstery, you know, changing the carpets, laying out the sofa, you know, changing your furniture here, there, right, and dressing the place up, doing the curtains, you know, just in the same way that you do with your real house, the kid does it with their playhouse. So who's the kid again? Don't answer that. Just like, you know, when you were younger, you used to play with toy cars. Yeah, men grow up and they play with their real cars. So the kid never dies inside. I'm talking about a kid mentality. It's not about how big or small they are, right, in terms of the size of the thing you play with. Whether it's a playhouse or a real house, for as long as you believe that happiness comes in the way you've arranged your home, your house pride, right? For as long as you believe that is where your pleasure comes from, you are a kid. It's a very kiddish satisfaction that you seek. I hope I'm not offending anyone. And I don't mean to. I just want you to open your eyes and realize the truth. I just want you to free yourself from this slavery that you put yourself through. I want you to be happy unconditionally, because your happiness right now is conditional, ladies and gentlemen. You have to agree. If you walk up this next, you know, tomorrow morning, walk up in front of the mirror, wake up and walk up in front of the mirror, and you see all your hairs fallen out of your head, how would you feel? Ladies, especially. You've lost all your hair. You know when people get cancer, right, and they have to go through this chemotherapy and so on, and they start losing the hair, one of the things that people who live with them do is what? They shave their heads, right? You've seen this stuff, yeah? They shave their heads out of sympathy. You know, I respect people for doing that, but I think it's an insult to the person who's going through that. I'll tell you why that is satisfying. Now, you know, please don't take any of this the wrong way. All I want to do is share with you the truth. Okay? And if this is too much to stomach, then I apologize to you in advance. But I just want you to open your eyes and realize the truth, so that you can be free from this tomfoolery. That's all. Right? Let's say I got cancer and I shaved my, I had to, bad example. But, you know, just to be honest, I'll take myself, right? So none of you feel offended, right? Let's say I had hair, a head full of hair, and I got cancer and I'm going through treatment and my hair starts falling out. So Venerable Swami Nohanse here, he also decides to shave his head, right? Just out of sympathy. I'll tell you why that works. It works, but I'll tell you why it works. When I start losing my hair, I feel sympathy for myself. I feel bad about myself because I'm constantly comparing myself with others. This is to do with ego. This is to do with ego. I'm comparing myself with others. So I look at others, they have a head full of hair, and I go, I don't have one. I feel undermined. Inferiority gets the better of me. And the reason for this is this. This might sound really vicious and vile. So again, please don't take this the wrong way. When we suffer, it's a very dirty trait of the mind. It's the mind I'm talking about, not any of you individually, okay? This is just the mind. When the mind suffers, it doesn't like to see other people enjoying. That's the way it is. When it suffers, when I suffer, I don't like to see other people having a good time. It's terrible, isn't it? That's what ignorance does to you. That's why when you get a low grade at an exam, and you walk around asking your friends, what did you get? Right? You get three responses. If they've got the same as you, okay, yeah, it was a tough exam, wasn't it? Yeah, it was a tough exam, wasn't it? Because now you're equals. This is sadhisamana, ego. If they've got a lower mark than you, is that all you got? I mean, you haven't scored great either. But there, you got 70, or maybe you got 50, they got 30. Is that all you got? See, I got 50. I got a better mark than you. In fact, whether you vocalize this or not, inside of you, you feel good about it. Because you feel you're better than others. Comparison. You can't help this stuff. It comes to you so naturally. And I want you to be okay with that for the time being. Just be okay with that. Alright? These are the hidden truths that no one speaks out loud about. Because it seems that we are terrible. How can we as human beings feel this way? But we do. We do. How do I know this? I read it in a book, did I? No, folks. Been there, done that. That's why I feel privileged to talk to you. Because I know where we all come from. We all have the same roots because we all started at ignorance. And we are waking our way up, freeing ourselves from ignorance. So if I've gone some distance, I know you can come the same distance as well. But there's more to go. And my teachers have gone that far, so I know that there's further to go. And we can free ourselves from this. But if someone's got higher than you, if someone's got a better mark than you, you don't like that. You don't like that. It's not a nice feeling. If, say, you know, there are floods, right? And you go, you get news, you go, you wake up in the morning and your house is flooded. Three blocks down, houses are also flooded. Okay, my house is flooded, but their houses are also flooded, then that's fine. But my house is flooded and theirs aren't. I don't like that. See, try and catch yourself when you do that, when it happens to you. It's very subtle. You have to be very, this is where mindful awareness is needed. Be completely mindfully aware. You will realize when it's happening within you. But don't hate yourself for it. It's not to hate, it's just to recognize. Right? There is no self-hating in Buddhism. You don't do that. Because that is once again an obstacle to your self-purification. Regret, there's no room for regret in Buddhist philosophy. We talked about this at length in yesterday's talk at the monastery. Don't ever let regret get the better of you. I was talking to an audience and I was asking them, you know, perhaps there are among you those who have adulterated. Perhaps there are among you who, you know, those who have had an extramarital relationship and your wife didn't know about it. Don't beat yourself up about it now. It happened. Yes, it happened. That's it. Let's move on. Maybe there are those among you who cheated. Maybe there are those among you who lied, who stole. And to this day, nobody else knows, but you do. Don't let guilt destroy you. The purpose of these sermons are not for me to spell out bad deeds so that then you begin to realize, oh God, I've done all these terrible things, I'm going to be going to hell. No question about that. This is the sermon. You know, why should I be telling you that then? You know, what is the whole point of me coming here and telling you, you're all damned to hell? Why come at all in the first place? I'm not here to tell you that you're all going to hell. I'm here to tell you that your actions now will determine your future. So, you know, if among you there are those who have sinned, you know, as Jesus said once, may who has not sinned cast the first stone. Remember they found this woman? Who was a prostitute, and they brought her, or an adulterer, and they brought her into the middle of the square, and people are all surrounded her with stones in their hands, wanting to attack her. And then what did Jesus say? He who has not sinned may cast the first stone. And they all dropped and they went back home. Sin has been a part of our lives, unfortunately. Cheating, lying, stealing, killing. Yes, we've not killed any human beings perhaps, but what about the house flies? What about the mosquitoes? What about the cockroaches? What about the rodents that thought that they would have it their way in your house? Last week I reminded you, you know, don't ever catch yourself taking anything from the workplace home. Right? Don't ever do that. If it's not yours for your work, then don't take it home. It's not for domestic use, it's for your work use. But as I said, so perhaps there may be some among you who thought, God, I've done that so many times. I did it only last night as well. How terrible of me. I'm going to hell. No, this is not to tell you that you're going to hell. You don't need me to tell you that. I'm here to tell you, don't beat yourself up about it. But don't do it. Don't do it again. Right? That's it. We've done our fair share of sins. That's it. Don't do it again. Maybe there's someone among you who's had an abortion. Perhaps. Maybe no one knows. You had a relationship with someone. Right? Nobody knew about it. But one thing led to another. And only 3 months in, you realize you were having a baby. But you couldn't tell anyone about it. So you went. You got it done. And it's been a stain, a scar in your life since, ever since. I say this, ladies and gentlemen, because I have spoken to people like this. People who've gone through this experience. If that is so, then yes, when I say, you know, killing is bad, you think, what hope is there for me now to escape my misery? The inevitable is going to come. I say no. That is why the Buddha is our greatest blessing. Here's what the Buddha taught us. You can throw the frisbee, but before it comes back round, you can get the hell out of there. He teaches us a way to escape our own bad actions. The karmas, our own doings, our own sins, there's a way to escape that. Nigantanatha Putta, who was Buddha's contemporary, had a very different idea. He thought the only way that you can free yourself from all your misdoings is to pay the price, one at a time. So he thought the only way to cleanse yourself is to pay and repent and regret for all the sins you have done. The Buddha's teaching is not so. Perhaps by this point, ladies and gentlemen, you may have done deeds which will bring you rebirth in the four great hells. But if you become a sotapanna before your death, all that gone for good. You will never have to pay that price. You know, it's like getting a loan and running away without having to pay it back. I can't think of a better deal than that. That's why I say the Buddha was the biggest con man. And I love him for it. I love him for it. He teaches us how to escape the bad actions of, you know, our own actions. The evilness of our own actions. He teaches us the method to escape from that. Any deeds that you might have done which will bring you consequences in the sensual world, in the karma world, you can escape as soon as you become an anagami. Once you are born in the Brahma world, none of the consequences of your actions that will bring fruit in the sensual world will come after you. Because there is, the reason for this is again the cause and effect. Causes can have to line up in the right environment. If the environment is not present, no matter how potent the seed is, it cannot take root. So, to relate that to this, the analogy to this situation, no matter how strong the power of your karma is, unless we speak of an anantariya karma, no matter how potent your karma is, if you don't create the environment for that karma, it will not take root. That is why when Ajasattva, the king Ajasattva, went to see the Buddha, there's a sutta called the Samanyapala Sutta. He goes and asks the Buddha, "Venerable sir, what are the fruits of recluseship? For becoming a recluse, a sramana, what are the fruits of that?" There are various teachers who give various teachings about the fruits of becoming a sramana. But in your sasana, what is the fruit? What are the fruits of becoming a sramana? And the Buddha goes on to give a great exposition about the various fruits, the various advantages of becoming a sramana. And towards the end, he says, "Great king, the greatest fruit of all is the fruit of arahatship." So the Venerable, King Ajasattva, he listens to this discourse and he pays his veneration to the Buddha and he says, "Venerable sir, you have shown me something I've never seen before, but and thank you very much for your instruction." But he takes his leave from the Buddha. He says, "I have much to attend to, so please, with your permission, I beg to leave." And he leaves. In fact, he even seeks forgiveness from the Buddha. For what sin? Do you remember? For what sin? Having killed his father. Patricide. Right? But that is one of the heinous sins. And an anantariya papa karma, you have to pay the price for that. There is no option. But he seeks the Buddha's forgiveness. Now, here's another point that we can prove. You know, when we at the end of sermons, at the end of meritorious deed, you say, "Kāyena vācā cittena pamādena mayā katan acchayaṁ kamma me bhante bhūripaññā tathāgata acchayaṁ kamma me dhamma sandittika kālika acchayaṁ kamma me saṅgha supatipanna anuttara." Right? Don't think that what you have done is completely washed away all the sins. That is not what happens. Because some people think if you go once to Kalani temple, go worship at Kalani temple, and all the sins you have done right from birth are washed away. Unfortunately, not so. That is not how it works. It is because people don't understand what is meant by that verse. Kalani is not Kalani temple. But if you've been going to Kalani temple, please continue to go to Kalani temple. Okay? Got nothing against that. Kalani is not that. Kalani is Kalyana. Nobleness. If you aspire to nobleness, if you attain nobleness, that is why I told you one of these years, I'll explain to you what this worshipping is, right? Vandana. Vandana is not just getting on your knees and doing a worship. Vandana has a much more profound meaning than that. So Varak Vendot Kalani is not going to Kalani temple and offering flowers and worshipping. That's not what it means. Well, from my point of view. Because then, you can sin all your life. And then everyone can... Now, why don't they relocate the prison to next to Kalani temple? All the sinners can just go to the Kalani temple, offer some flowers, and then they're all redeemed from their sins. That's not how it works. In fact, by the Buddha's teaching, once you've done a bad deed, it follows you like the ox, like the wheel of the cart follows the ox. But there is one way in which you can escape the consequences of your bad deeds, and that is by Kalani Vandana. Not that Kalani. Aspiring to nobleness, When I explain to you one of these days what Vandana is, you will understand. But Kalani for the time being is nobleness. Nobleness meaning freedom from raga, dvesha and moha. Once you become a sotapanna, all bad deeds that would have brought you rebirth in the four great hells washed away. Because you no longer create the environment for those seeds to take root. That's why. Cause and effect. Once you become an anagami, any sins that have been done to take fruit in the sensual worlds, gone for good because you no longer create the environment for those seeds to take root. That's why. That is what is meant by Varak Vendut Kalani. So they have a lot of meaning. You just need to look at it through that lens. So why does this look beautiful? I got sidetracked again, didn't I? You listen so attentively. I mean, whose fault is that? As I explain things to you, you're like, some of you don't even bat an eyelid from the moment you come here. No, I see some of you, they're like that. They don't even bat an eyelid. Must be because, you know, you feel how fortunate you are to receive the Buddha's teaching. Well, good on you. Good on you. So, you know, you encourage me to carry on and I just carry on and I don't even realize I've jumped track and gone somewhere. Anyhow, coming back to this, beauty is not in the flower. So how does beauty happen? The mind faculty, when it is ridden with ignorance, expects beauty to come from the flower. You can expect whatever you want. Doesn't mean it's going to come to you. You can expect the moon, but it's not going to come to you. Right? So you expect the happiness to come to you from the flower. And then when presented the flower, you are relieved of that vexation because the object of your waiting, has been delivered to you. That is why you are relieved. And that relief is what you experience as pleasure. So therefore, that by extension should explain to you why it is that familiarity breeds contempt. If this flower is beautiful, then all you would need is this flower for beauty. But you know, well and truly, you know, if you do flower arrangements at home, maybe if you have a flower bed or something, you know, from time to time you change them, right? You change them around. This week you have daffodils, maybe in 6 months' time you have roses. You change from time to time. Why so? Why do you paint, you know, color wash your walls from time to time? Why do you change the colors? Why do you change your upholstery? Change your, you know, the colors of your furniture. You go through that change from time to time because you like that change. It's not the change that you like. What you're looking for is pleasure. And you think the next thing is going to bring you pleasure. So you're kept waiting for that. And when you get it, you're relieved from that waiting. And that relief from waiting, relief from expectation, is what you experience as pleasure. See, what I want you to do then, ladies and gentlemen, is over the course of next week, take as many examples as you possibly can. And I invite you to take at least five, right? At least on five instances, try and reason within your mind why you experience pleasure from the association of those objects. And those objects can come in many ways. It can come either in sights, sounds, smell, taste, touch, whatever. If you walk home today and open your wardrobe, there'll be lots of items of clothing which, when you bought, you really liked them. You wanted them on you, you always wore them, right? But after a while, you know, they started going to the back drawers. And then again, a little while later, you will maybe even give it away to somebody. What happens when you buy a new phone? Aya? Malli gets the old phone, right? Why so? But when you bought it for the first time, when you brought it home with you, that was the latest thing. It was the best thing because it was new. It was new to you. It doesn't have to be new. It's new to you. Shall I prove that point to you? What about when you buy a used car? When you buy a used car, it's not a new car. but it's new to you. The old owner of the car, right, will not treat it as well as you do to it, as you do it, because you are now the new owner of the car. In other words, actually, it's only new to you. Remember when you first bought that car home? Now, those of you who have a car, you know, you're pretty much everyone has a car. When you first bought that car home, right, you didn't even let your kids get into it. Remember how you closed the door? Before you closed the door, you did what? And then now? Okay. So when you bought the car, right, remember how you closed the door? Right? Gently. Without making a noise. Right? Just in case it might hurt the door. Right? You close the door gently and then press it. Press it in. You don't like slam it, you press it in. But say your friend comes along, you know, you're just giving someone a lift. And when he shuts the door, oh, you know, this is very typical of, you know, couples at home. Right? If the man loves the car, the wife, not such a car fan. Huh? When she gets the shopping, both hands she has the shopping, and she only needs one leg to stand on, right? And the door is open. So it's time to make use of the other leg. So what do you do when a door is open and you have two bags in either hand and you can manage yourself on one foot? The other leg can be used to shut the door. And when you do that, what did your husband say? See, now he forgets that this is the wife that he brought home, right? On a, what do you call them, what is this, dolal? What's it called? Huh? On a palanquin, yes, on a palanquin. He forgets, this is the wife I brought home on a palanquin. This is the queen that I brought home with me. But now I have another queen. The car. So why do you love the car more than you love your wife now? Familiarity breeds contempt. The car is new, the wife is old. And when the kids come in, puta puta puta, careful, right? Dust your feet. Come on, you've all done this, right? Remember the carpets? Remember the carpets went in before you got into the car? And you had to dust your feet, you know, rub your feet together, hit them together to get all the dust off before you put your feet into the car, right? For how long? First week, second week, third week, by about the third month, right? Even the dog had a seat in the car. Remember when you went to the fish market? You had to go to the fish market and you told your wife what? Honey, let's not have fish. I don't mind that, but I am not bringing any fish in my car. Not this car. She's my baby. No fish, please, because the car's going to stink. Because you like the new car smell, right? The leather, because everything was so new, not new, but new to you. Even when it was a second-hand car, the same applied. You know, in just the same way a man treats a brand new car, a man treats a second-hand car if it's new to him. Because vexation has just been relieved. And therefore, they experience pleasure. And they think, this car is the source of my pleasure. So if the car is the source of my pleasure, now I have to protect it. When the car was new, if someone like opened the door and it left a dent on your car, how did you feel? Your jaw dropped, didn't it? It almost felt like your heart, you spat out your heart, you know, when you saw that. But, you know, after a while, Because, you know, after a while, you sometimes reverse your car into the back, into the wall, you're driving around, you bump into things, and after a while, it just becomes, you know, you get used to it. Because it's no longer the object of your vexation. That's why. And then, here's when this is the last nail on the coffin. You watch this TV advert and they say, the new model is here. When the new model is out, now all this while, right, all you could see was how good your old car was. Right? She was beautiful, wasn't she? In that deep, in that royal blue. Right? It was a beautiful car. But now you want the old model, all you can see are her faults. Because now you want the new model. Now it's not spacious enough. The car doesn't drive well. The steering doesn't turn well. The AC doesn't blow well. But the seat belt is too tight. There's not enough leg room. Not enough room for the kids. It's not comfortable enough. All these complaints now. Why? Because now you have your eye on the new car. So what do? You sell this car to somebody else. And when they buy it, it's the object that they have been vexing for. They carry the car on their head. That's why they say, one man's trash is another man's treasure. It's all in the mind. It's not in the car. Neither treasure nor trash is in the object. Please wake up and realize this, ladies and gentlemen, so you can be freed from your own slavery. Wake up. Pleasure is not in the object. Pleasure is not in your car. It's not in your house. It's not in anything. These are all makings of the mind, because the mind relieves itself from vexation. Because when the chitta goes into vexation, it waits for that object to come into being. It waits for the object to manifest. And at one point where this chitta rises, at this point, it doesn't experience it because the chitta hasn't arisen yet. So the whole process, you know, this whole process, it completes once it's gone one cycle. Okay? So receiving, registering, recognizing, responding and perceiving. The whole process is complete in one cycle. So until this cycle is complete, you haven't perceived the entire object. So while it's at this point, it's still waiting for this object in the hope that it's going to bring me pleasure. So the chitta arises. And at some point the object falls. Or let's say at the beginning the object falls and it takes on the object. And now it starts to receive, it starts to register it, starts to perceive it. And the process continues. And the process happens rather. At one point, it recognizes the object and realizes this is the object I've been waiting for. When recognition happens, you know this is the object I've been waiting for. If it is the object you've been waiting for, now you're no longer waiting. It's like the sun who comes to you once every 2 years. We talked about this. Your boy comes home once every 2 years. He lives in Australia. He's gone there for his higher education. He comes every 2 years. How do you treat him? Like a prince. For how long though? 2 weeks. Again, absence makes the heart grow fonder. You know, you didn't love him or show him as much affection when he was with you, did you? You didn't show him so much affection when he was with you. But when he's not with you, and he comes for a short stay, for a short visit, so much love, so much affection. That's one of the best things you can do as a family. One of the best things you can do as a family is spend some time away from each other. Once in a while. So the mother, father, children, spend some time away from each other. Because when you're away from each other, you will begin to long for their association. You will begin to vex again. The morning tea, the morning newspaper, the cooked breakfast, you're going to start missing them. The washed dishes, the washed laundry, the ironed shirts and the trousers, you're going to start missing all them. The sweet voice, It's not sweet when it's heard every day. That's the thing. Remember when you were younger, right? When you were first getting into that relationship, you waited day and night, counting days and nights to hear that voice, didn't you? You know, though these days we have mobile phones, but back then, right? Perhaps, you know, in your father's or your grandparents' time. Actually, we don't need to go that far. You know, go back to your parents' time. You know, when I was younger, I think by the age of 14 or 15 was when I actually got to use a phone. Not have my own phone, but actually got to use a phone. Until then, I hadn't even used a mobile phone. So actually, going back to some of your earlier years, right, you probably didn't have a phone. So when you were dating, right, or actually getting into a relationship with someone, getting to know someone, you didn't have this close association. You only got to see them once a week, maybe once every 2 weeks. You had to get on the train to go and see her. You had to wait for the bus to go and see her. You had to wait till New Year's Eve to see her, right? And that waiting just kept you vexing. And at the end, that vexation was relieved. So when you heard that voice, it was like honey. It was like trickle in your ears. But then you decided, I want to hear that voice every day. Tell me, was that the right or the wrong choice? So then you brought that voice so that they could be with you every day. And now from time to time, you'll catch you saying, shut up already. Must you always talk? Sometimes you'll catch you saying this. I'm saying, you know, it's not just your home, every home is the same. It's just the way it is. That's how the mind works. My grandfather used to say, Achama kiyavanava, kiyavanava, kiyavanava. Don't get her started, she won't stop. But I'm sure when he was younger, he would have done anything to get her started. What I need you to do is to understand how the mind works. These are all tricks of the mind. You are cheated by your own mind. Come to that awareness. So for homework, think of 5 things. Just, you know, keep your eyes and ears open. And you will experience them. 5 things that will bring you pleasure. Right? It could be in the things you eat. Right? Maybe something you watch. Something you smell. Right? Now you know where these objects come from. It is your 5 senses. Right? Just be mindful and catch yourself when you experience a moment of pleasure. And when you catch that moment of pleasure, ask yourself, is it the object that has brought me pleasure, or is it purely the relief from my internal vexation that has brought me this pleasure? How do we prove this? If it is the object, then the same object must bring you pleasure continuously. Pleasure today, pleasure tomorrow, pleasure the day after, it doesn't continue. Yeah, even though your favorite item of food, how many times can you eat it before you say, enough, can I have something else, please? And the other point is, although you enjoy it, not everyone does. If pleasure is in the object, everyone should enjoy it the same. Now, betel leaves, right? You know there are people who chew on betel leaves, right? Do you? Some of you may, some of you won't. Right? Because some of you say, no, it's bitter. Why would you chew on betel leaves? It's so bitter. Whereas others will say, oh yeah, that's where I get my fix, my daily fix. Once, one in the morning, one after tea, that's how I get my daily fix. You know, maybe back in our grandparents, you know, those times, you know, people used to do it quite a lot. But, you know, today, and today's day and age, you know, you see very, very seldom it happens. So, if that joyfulness is in the betel leaf, then we should all be able to enjoy that. But we don't. Some like bitter gourd, others don't. They hate it. Some like chocolate. You know, there are people who don't like chocolate. You think, what? Yes. So why is it you all like chocolate then? It's because from a very young age, it was what was indoctrinated in our minds. If not the chocolate, at least the sweet taste was indoctrinated in our minds. Because what did our parents give to us as treats? Sweets. Yeah? They never gave us mallum. as a treat. It was always chocolate, a candy bar, something sweet, right? So we grew up with that indoctrination, that sweet was the taste of reward. That is what we grew up with. Biologically, you know, there may be some connection, because I remember studying for biology that the body has an affinity for sweetness because it is high in calories, and then that is the body's source of energy. So the body has a high affinity for sweetness, perhaps. But there is also a mental aspect here that we must consider. So a lot of the things that you like today are because that is what you grew up with. Maybe your sisters, your brothers who lived with you, you know, those were I used to love to listen to Amardev Mahatya's songs. I loved my classical music. That is because at home, Appachi used to listen to Amardev Mahatya. That is what I grew up with. And, you know, I the friends I associated, you know, we liked classical music. So growing up, I enjoyed that stuff. But not everyone likes classical music. So then you can't say that beauty is in the music. It's all in the mind. So why do we try to understand this? Once you understand this, you no longer become slaves to the outside world objects and the people who control them. Because in this world, ladies and gentlemen, people control things. The sights you see, the sounds you hear, the smells you inhale, they're all controlled by somebody. You don't believe me? Why is a prison sentence a prison sentence? Answer that question and you'll get the answer to this one. Why is a prison sentence a prison sentence? In prison, they feed you for free, they clothe you for free, they shelter you for free, and when you're unwell, they treat you for free. So your body gets everything it needs. But the mind is not given what it wants. Not what it needs. It's not given what it wants. Because the mind wants to watch TV, they hardly get that. The mind wants to go on trips, they don't get that. The mind wants to be with friends and family, they don't get that. The mind wants to see the color red, and they don't get that. That is why a dark room is a punishment. So how, if you ever get, you know, sometimes you say, you know, if the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, right? I'm going to give you the Prisoner's Guide to stay sane in a prison. If ever you get in prison, you're not planning on doing that, are you? But just in case, right? In case you ever get prisoned and you have to serve a prison sentence in a dark room, I tell you, you needn't suffer. It needn't be a prison sentence to you. If you have understood the Dhamma, you cannot be imprisoned. Put me in a prison cell. I won't suffer. So you can't punish me by putting me in a prison cell. For as long as you feed me, because I feel hunger, I'll need something to put over my body. When I'm ill, I'll need some medicines, right? And I'll need shelter. So I'll need these four things, the basic requisites. Every human being needs these things, and these are not optional. But besides that, I don't need to watch TV. I don't need to go on the internet. I don't need to listen to music. I don't need to look at things to enjoy myself. I don't need to be with someone in particular. But why is prison prison? Because there are people you want to be with. There are things you want to do. There are places you want to be. Therefore, there's always the threat of prison. I'm free from that threat. So I cannot be imprisoned. You can imprison my body, but you can't imprison my mind. You can't imprison my mind. Wouldn't you like to have that freedom? What price are you willing to pay for that? Some of you imprison yourselves to a bottle of liquor. Because you think that is where happiness comes from. I want to free you. But not by asking you to observe the precept of Sura Mere Majvama Dattana. No, no, no. I want you to understand that happiness does not come in a bottle. Some of you maybe enjoy yourselves and pleasure yourselves by eating as much as you can. Just keep on shoving stuff into your bodies. It's not good for your body. Because the body has a limit. Because this is a very natural instrument. Right? Your body has a right amount of sugar, it has a right amount of lipid, it has a right amount of carbohydrates, all these things, it has a right amount, an optimum amount the body needs. Put any more than that because the mind wants it and you are ruining your bodies. Put any less than that and you're again ruining your bodies. So there's an optimum amount. But when you become slave to the tastes, to your taste buds, now you're out of control. And then later on you begin to suffer. So you don't need to be like that. I'm here to free you from that burden. The Buddha's teaching is here to free you from that burden. If to enjoy yourself, you have to go on a trip once every 2 weeks. You have to go sightseeing. You have to go to a party. You have to go to the club. Without your music, if you can't survive. I'm here to free you from that burden. You don't need to be like that. So whatever you are a slave to, just let the Dhamma heal you. Just let the Dhamma do its part. I promise you, you don't have to do anything else other than bringing yourself here and paying attention to what the Swaminathan has to say. The Dhamma will do its magic. Because you can't not understand this, can you? I say flower, can you not understand it? I mean, can you deliberately not understand it? You can't, because understanding is not a passive, it's not an active process, it's a passive process. You understand. If you know the context, if you know the words, if they have meaning, you understand. Because perception is not an act, it's not a doing thing, it's a done thing. Like understanding is a done thing. So this is done. Nibbana is also done. You don't have to do Nibbana. Just let Nibbana happen to you. Just let freedom happen to you. Come here, listen to the talks. Let the teaching be absorbed. It'll happen to you. And freedom will come when it comes. That's it. Sotapanna will happen to you when it happens. Don't you worry. Sakrudagami will happen to you when it happens. Anagami will happen to you when it happens. And Arahat will happen to you when it happens. You may not even know it has happened to you. You don't need to know. Just let it happen to you. That's why my teacher always tells me, don't struggle for Arahathood. Don't struggle for Sotapannahood. To become an Anagami. Make your struggle a struggle to free yourself from suffering. If your mind is at ease, who cares whether that is Arahathood or Sotapanna? Who cares? If your mind is at ease, that is what we're here for. So make that your only goal. Therefore, I will never be issuing you a certificate to say, Madam, you're a Sotapanna, you're an Anagami, you're a... No, I say this because in some places apparently they do that. For 25,000, you get a certificate that you are a Sotapanna. 75,000, you can get an Anagami certificate. Don't fall for that nonsense. Because when people want the money in your pockets, they'll be hell-bent on it, ladies and gentlemen. Have sympathy for them, because what they understand is beauty comes in the object, and to get that object, they need money. You have the money, and you want to become a Sotapanna, so they give you Sotapanna, you give them money. So therefore, let me tell you now, if you have any hope of becoming a Sotapanna, let go of that. If you want to become an Anagami, let go of that. Just want to free from suffering. That's it. Otherwise, you will go after people who will promise you, Sotapanna in 7 days. How's that? A 2-week course. At the end of that, you become a Sotapanna, we even give a certificate. Signed by the president of the society. Don't fall for that rubbish. That is not for us to go holding placards and say, stop doing this stuff, why are you fooling people? No. Let them do what they have to do. Because, everyone has to make a living. Yeah, people have to live. And if that's the way they're going to live, then that's the way they're going to live. But don't you fall for that. You are more meritorious than that. You have ample merits to bring yourselves to the truth, the true teaching of the Buddha. Now that you're here, just let the Dhamma do its magic to you. That's why I say, don't give up anything. Don't give up anything. Don't offer everything you have to the Sambuddha Sasana either. No. First, offer yourself. Offer yourself to the Sasana. Sabba Papasa Akaranam is the first offering you can do to the Sasana. Sabba Papasa Akaranam. Stop all unmeritorious deeds. That is the first offering to the sasana. Kusalasa Upasampada is the second offering to the sasana. Engage in as many meritorious deeds as possible. Do kusala. Help others. Help other people out of their pitiful states. Help other people out of their miseries. Bring them to a sermon if you can. That's one of the best things you can do for people. I can't think of any better thing that you can do for someone than to help open their eyes to the Dhamma. Do that. I know there are some among you who bring your parents here because you want them to realize the true teaching as well, because you know how much sacrifice they've made on your behalf. Every drop of milk that your mother shed for you, now you want to pay that price, don't you? That's why you bring your mother here. Every drop of sweat that your father shed on your behalf and no other, you want to pay that price. Therefore, you bring him here. If you can't bring them here, perhaps they're not there too old for it, but at least you take the Dhamma to them. You sit down with them, hold their hand and explain to them, Amma, I listened to a sermon today. I want to share with you just 5 minutes of what I captured. Please listen to this. And you know, you be the messenger. If they're not prepared to come here, why don't you take it to them? Do what you have to do. The Buddha says, keep your parents on either shoulder for 100 years and you will never be able to repay the debts, but introduce them to the true teaching of the Dhamma so that they can be freed once and for all from suffering. That is the only time you can actually free yourself and repay the entirety of any debts that you owe them. These are not my words, folks. This is the Buddha. So why do you think I'm here then? I sit in front of an audience who have been mothers and fathers to me throughout my journey of sansara. You have all been mothers to me and you have all been fathers to me. It is my time to pay my debt. There is not a single woman here who has not fed me her blood in the form of milk. Not a single man here who has not shed his blood and sweat on my behalf. Not a single one. And for that, I am eternally grateful, because thanks to your sacrifices, I went on to become a human being. And today I am a person who is able to enjoy the bliss of the sasana as I do. It's my time to pay those debts to you. There's a reason why you and I, we have come together. These are all sansaric transactions. Nothing happens just because. Everything happens for a reason. You and I are here under this one roof, me talking to you, because I have a debt to pay. I have a debt to pay. And I will pay that debt until I can. I want you to bring yourselves here so I can pay my debt and free you from suffering. My teacher is paying his debt. He's helping me, and through me he's helping you as well. This is how we're all connected. I don't expect to come back again into this world. This will be the last time, and that will be enough. But while my time is here, I want to repay as many of my debts as possible. So in asking you to bring someone else along, I'm not only asking on their behalf, but I also want to repay my debts as well. So there's a hidden agenda. The sooner I can clear my debts, the sooner I can get out of here. So, may the Dhamma heal you. May the Dhamma set you free. And do your part for your family as well. That mother, that poor mother, your poor father, they're today, they may have a lot, but they're poor in health, they're poor in age. They've expended their youthful years serving you. Today you are as successful as you are. Your claim to fame is partly because of what they've done for you. I'll remind this to you from time to time, because I am someone who cares deeply about my parents and my teachers. I will go to hell and back if I can do for them. So do what you can for your parents. If they're not willing to come here, or if they're not prepared to come here, or perhaps they're not fit enough to come here, you know, take some of this to them. Go today, you know, get back home. Once you get home, why don't you explain to them how beauty works? Explain to them the principle of vexation. Do this, experiment with them and explain to them, Amma, you know, how, you know, pleasure doesn't come in the object, does it? It comes from relief from pain. See? Then they'll begin to understand something. And from that you can lead them on, one to another, one to the other. One day, who knows, they might be happy to come here. Maybe they'll happy to come to the monastery. Let's do our part. In serving others, we serve ourselves. That's how that happens. So you understand this? At least to a certain extent. That's alright. Blank faces are okay. That's fine. Because we'll talk about this again next week as well. And the following week, and the following week, and the following week. For as long as someone is here on this seat, they will have this talk with you. And for as long as someone is on that seat, this talk will happen. One person is enough. I don't need a room full of people. One person is enough. Whoever has the merits to be here will be here. Whoever doesn't have the merits to be here will when they have the merits. So we don't need to bring every man, every Tom, Dick and Harry here. We don't need to. Let them come when they can come. But we can encourage people. Right. It's time for today. A few questions here as well. I'll pick them up for next week. I'll take them with me, don't worry, so I can have them here for next week. So is ignorance bliss? If ignorance is bliss, then you should all be blissful and not be here. Your very being here is evidence that ignorance is not bliss. You're ignorant to think that beauty comes in a flower. Therefore, you fall victim to this. You are prey to this. You are a slave to this. If I want to make you unhappy, all I have to do is this. See? Because you like this flower. See? If you like this flower, that's all I have to do. What I've done to the flower, I've just done to your mind. Why do you let me do that? Don't let me do that. What if that was your child? What if that was your house? What if that was your land, your property, your car, your watch, your phone, your favorite dress? All I have to do is hold it in my hands and pull it apart, right? And I can make you suffer. Why do you let me do that to you? Why don't you be the master of your own happiness? Don't be slaves to others. Rise up. Rise up strong. That is what the Dhamma will help you do. Don't let anyone destroy your life. Become independent. This is the Dhamma is the way to independence, true independence. The day you become an Arahant will be your independence day. That day we shall celebrate. The 4th of February we'll all celebrate. But your day you become an Arahant, I think is the day worth celebrating. I long for that day. Where I can go up to my teacher and tell him, Kina Jati, Venerable Sir, I have done it. With your help and all the blessings of everyone who surrounded me right from the start, all these people who have been mothers and fathers to me in my whole journey on samsara, I have fulfilled the holy life. I have done what is there to do and nothing more left to do. I am free of all suffering. I long for that day. That is the only hope that I have left. None of these things make me happy. You can't please me by giving me anything. Your veneration, your worship doesn't please me. I accept it because it does good to you. That's why I accept it. You don't have to come and worship me at all. If at the end of the sermon, come and fart in my face and go away, that's fine. That's fine. I don't do it with any expectation in return. I'm here to pay my debts, not to ask for something again. Right, let's do a merit transfer and bring today's sermon to a close. Okay, so first and foremost, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching. And in making an invitation to the Swami Nuhansi to preach the sermon today, in preparing this venue and making it available for all to come from all corners of the country and come along and sit down and comfortably and listen to the sermon, as well as those who made the requisites available, the facilities available, refreshments available, may they all rejoice in these merits, reminding ourselves how grateful we must be to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, so let us transfer these merits to them, for it is they who have preserved and protected the sublime teachings of the Buddha, and captured it in form of the Tripitaka and passed it down to generations of the noble lineage, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters who dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us also transfer these merits to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer these merits to my teacher, Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarika and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be thereby translating these talks, sharing them out with others or inviting others to join them. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to friends of the monastery, our devotees, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who provide for the construction of the monastery, to those who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, aims, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May by the power of these merits, they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employees and our teachers who've always gone the extra mile on our behalf, who've helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form possible and available to them. May they all rejoice in the merits that we have all acquired today, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, and primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to protect and fulfill the sum of the sasana. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful lie over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our loved ones, those who have passed away in our name, our ancestors, our forefathers, as it is in the fruits of their labor. Today we are able to listen to the Dhamma and practice the path in comfort. May they all rejoice in these merits for having shed the blood, sweat and tears as they did so selflessly and so generously. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to the members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who have lost their lives to natural in the wars, be they friend or foe. Let us also transfer these merits to those who have lost their lives to natural disasters such as the tsunamis, earthquakes, landslides, fires, blizzards, pandemics and so on. Reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, brothers and sisters to us, friends and acquaintances to us, those that will have made ample sacrifices on our behalf. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May by the power of these merits, they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And may you and I, and everyone who's helped make this program a success, become a Rahatan Vahanse or an Arahat Terunin Vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. And the members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you.
Raga ginnen midatva, dvesha ginnen midatva, moha ginnen midatva, Nibbana Parama Sukhayan sukhita-tara-vetma nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita-tara-vetma mamada-syalu-loka syalu-satmayo nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetma nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetma nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetma raga gini niveva desha gini niveva moha gini niveva nivansata ladeva nivansata ladeva nivansata ladeva
tunjuvange suvisi ananta maha guna velen siru loka siru sattvayoma nibbana parama sukhen sukita taravetva sadu sadu sadu.